Hey guys, it's Brandon from the MacroOps Value Hive podcast. At MacroOps, our aim is simple. We want to make high risk-adjusted returns consistently, continuously learn while doing so, and have a lot of fun along the way. And in this regard, our record speaks for itself. This is partly why we have by far the highest retention rates of any investing service in the industry. Collective members tend to stay members for a long time because there really is nothing else like us. We offer differentiated research, theory, and education resources, plus a killer Slack community filled with some of the smartest operators from around the world. Our members are predominantly professionals, but we also have a high number of highly motivated retail investors and traders. The one thing we all share is a deep love for the game of investing and an unquenchable thirst to get better. If this sounds like you, then consider signing up and checking us out. You simply go to macro-ops.com/collective. That's macro-ops/collective. Before we dive into today's conversation, I want to talk to you about MIT Investment Management Company, also known as MITIMCO, the investment office of MIT. Each year, MITIMCO invests with a handful of new emerging managers who it believes can earn exceptional long-term returns in support of MIT's mission. In order to help the emerging manager community more broadly, they created emergingmanagers.org, a website for emerging manager stock pickers. For those looking to start a stock picking fund or those just looking to learn about how others have done it, I highly recommend this site. You'll find essays and interviews by successful emerging managers, service providers used by MIT's own fund managers, essays MITIMCO has written for emerging stock pickers, and more. MITIMCO also occasionally and opportunistically hires new members for their investment team. To view the job description, please visit mitimco.org/global-investor. That's mitimco.org/global-investor. The MITIMCO team spends their time learning about great businesses and investments, working with exceptional investors around the world in order to support generations of MIT innovators. David, good to have you on the podcast again. Last time we chatted, it was actually in person in Annapolis over some good food. And we talked about a lot of things, coal, microcaps, some random special situations, but we connected on one idea that we shared, which was Genk Restaurant, GENK. We both own it, disclosure. I own it personally. We own it, you know, at MacroOps. And so I'm biased. I think this thing works. I think this is Kura Sushi 2.0. That's what I wrote. And Kura ended up doing pretty well. So I think Genk is poised to do something similar. But before we get into that company and that deep dive, update us on what you got going on. What's going on in the coal space? I know you're heavy there. And anything else you're looking at before we tackle Genk?
Oh, man. Well, thanks for having me on again. It's good to be back. Man, it's been an interesting start to the year. There's been, lots of people comparing this to like 2021 and seeing a lot of the crypto space really doing well and some of these other AI growth names, you know, you got the Reddit IPO. That's not really my scene. Like you said, I'm a coal and office REIT and retail investor. So it's been kind of not the easiest time to sit, you know, watch some of the craziness happening in other parts of the market. It's been a fairly quiet start to the year by comparison. I think in terms of coal right now, I think the largest position we've got on that front is Warrior Met Coal, ticker HCC. We own that in the fund. Feel really good about their prospects here as they're getting Blue Creek up and running. It'll be a growth project for them to produce more met coal. We really like Warrior. I mean, it's really cheap on a free cash flow basis once you look at what they're going to be generating with Blue Creek. But even without it, it's pretty attractive here. They're self-funding that growth. They're still generating cash as they do that. Just balance sheet's in good shape. Company produces coal at a very low cost relative to other U.S. producers. They produce very high quality coal. They've been lapping a union strike that's allowed them to increase production relative to kind of where peers are at, which is also letting them lower costs. And people look at a step up in cost there this year and, you know, maybe not realize that there's some associated costs with getting Blue Creek online and are running through their P&L. They talked on their call a month ago about hiring 250 miners this year, some for their current operations and some for for the growth project there. And they'll start getting Blue Creek tons out of the ground this year. It'll probably be sold in 2025. So there's a lot going on there. It's very cheap in that space. It's been getting beaten up a little bit recently with shoulder season. Met prices generally going down, you know, late spring to some point like in May, June time frame. So, you know, it's interesting here. We think it's really cheap. I think it's a triple digit stock in the not too distant future. And even if not, just really think a lot has to go wrong there for you to do poorly from where it's currently trading.
You mentioned they are planning to hire 250 new miners. Did you get any idea on the cost inflation of that, like the labor wages, how much that's going up? Just because I know it's not easy to find 250 shovel-ready miners.
Yeah, no, they've been doing really good. I think, not to plug another podcast, but Matt Warder was on Andrew Walker's pod this week. He mentioned that Warrior's been running ads even up in West Virginia, trying to get guys to move down to Alabama. so they're certainly trying to find guys. I think one interesting thing, and maybe not a lot of people know this about coal mining, but if you work for Warrior, you're probably in the top 10% of wage earners in the state of Alabama. It's a very attractive job when it comes for, you know, total compensation and prospects down there. So, you know, you might not think like, hey, the guy with the big house down the street's a coal miner, but in Alabama, that's more likely than most places.
That's wild. He probably also might have like asbestos in his lungs and stuff like that.
Yeah, they hopefully have a good post-retiree medical plan over there too.
So you're in coal, you've been dipping your toes in office REITs. Talk to me about that. Like, what was the buying there? I mean, I think it was Enlop you played it through, right? And it's been working well. I remember you texting me, and I was not involved in office retail at all. I think you texted me like in early January before it really kind of popped. And I bought a little bit of it because I was like, you know, I trust you. Why not? Seems cheap enough. Made a very small position and it's kind of done well. Traded sideways since the middle of January. But walk us through that thesis.
Sure. Yeah, so I think I might have even thrown some shade at office REITs last time I was on here. So I've gotten religion on that front a little bit. The only real reason I got interested in Enlop was that it's a different kind of setup to a lot of the office space right now, and that it was spun out of WP Carey in November of last year with kind of the explicitly stated goal of liquidating their remaining office portfolio and dissolving. So, you know, unlike buying, you know, VNO or one of the more popular office names or larger ones, there's kind of an ongoing bet on valuations and rents in that space. I like Enlop being a lot shorter time horizon and fairly straightforward. You know, calculate the liquidation value of 59 assets, and doing that got me to a point that I was pretty comfortable buying a lot. Probably trading around $17 end of last year, early this year. And there's, you know, there's been a few other guys that have gotten involved as well. I've seen this one get branded as a popular on Twitter stock. So, you know, it's not, the thesis is out there. There's been a few blogs that have written it up. Overall though, it just felt like this was one where even after the run-up, you're buying it in the mid 20s, you're pretty much, if you look at the value of where the debt is, where the market cap is, it's basically equal to the amount of rent they have contracted with their remaining triple net tenants. So you're kind of just betting that they'll be able to sell these properties for more than the cash flow that they already have locked in there. You know, it's triple net, so these are very low expense properties. There's like the whole portfolio is like $7 million a year. There's not a lot of vacancy issues here. There's been a couple that went vacant, one in Arizona. It looks like they've already gotten 2 out of 3 floors released if you check the broker site. Good luck trying to contact the brokers. I think they've all been sufficiently turned off by special situations investors in the last few months. But keep an eye on the listing if you can kind of see stuff coming and going. And yeah, they sold, you know, you mentioned the pop in January. They sold 4 of the 59 properties in the first month after the spin. And they sold those at an aggregate of about 8% cap rate, which was notable given that the stock is trading right now at close to a 15% cap rate. So, you know, people saw that and kind of made a few people sit up and realize like, oh, there's, you know, there might be some value here. Mm-hmm. And what's been interesting is with those sales and then with the UK one they sold at the beginning of January, the first five sales, three of the five were vacant or going vacant. And so I think some people looked at the you know, aggregate realizations there and thought, oh, well, maybe these are the good properties. And it's like, well, actually, I think there was a guy on Twitter that had ranked them by like where they were in metro areas, and two of the four that sold in January were the bottom two on his list in terms of how metros were doing with office exposure. So, you know, it's a small sample size, but overall, I think those are really encouraging data points. And my general belief has been that this will liquidate for more than where it's trading, and you'll get a decent return.
Now, I'm going to bring up Children's Place because you plugged another podcast on my podcast. So Children's Place has been one of the weirdest stories in retail, probably over the last year at least. And for those that don't know, the short story is this thing traded down from the end of January to the middle of February, like 70%. And then I think some Arab or Saudi fund came in and said, we're going to buy a bunch of this, shot up 350%. And then since that high, it is now down 71% to where it trades today. So in the course of 3 months from the end of January, you have down 66, up 350, down 70. What a ride.
Yeah, this is not one of the best investments I've made in my career. I talked about Children's Place pretty extensively over the last year, 15 months. I thought they had a pretty clear runway to generate a lot of cash flow after lapping a lot of cotton and freight issues. Mm-hmm. And what ended up happening, I mean, they were as recently as September, mid-September, halfway through their peak season, they were at the B. Riley conference and telling everybody, like, we're going to obliterate our guidance. Things are good. And apparently they didn't have their finger on their cost issues at their distribution center, because someone opened up one up down the road from them in Alabama. And somewhere in the second half of the third quarter, their costs blew out on overtime and labor. And they ended up generating a lot less than I was expecting in cash flow. Just not something that I had accounted for. It's a frustrating outcome. Things break in retail. I've never been run over by adjacent distribution center surprise labor pressure before, especially given how late in the quarter that seems to have cropped up.
Yeah.
But yeah, that really hurt their cash generation. But they kind of came out and were like, hey, this is addressable. We're working on it. And then went right back into quiet period. There wasn't a whole lot going on there until, you know, end of January, I think it was, when there was a leak on Bloomberg that said they were working with restructuring advisors.
Yep.
That was not part of my expectations. So, I mean, I tweeted at the time, but that night after hours, I blew out our entire stake and viewed that as, you know, this is a thesis breaker. There's no reason they should be having a liquidity crunch right now, given what I was expecting. And the company put out a press release the next morning, which honestly created more questions for me than answers. And I was like, well, I'm glad I'm out of this thing. I sold last night and the stock opened up down like 70% or something. Mm-hmm. Crazy. And well, lo and behold, this family office over in Saudi decided to buy 54% of the common in the open market over the ensuing week. I have never experienced that either. So there's quite a few firsts on this investment.
That's weird. You didn't have that in your model.
Yeah, that was admittedly unaccounted for. And yeah, so they squeezed it from when it opened at $8 that week, and I think it topped out at 38 a few days later on them buying half the common. But I would say that one's not out of the woods yet. They've since gone back to like 11 or 12. The family office that bought all the shares has also extended a $78 million interest-free loan to the company, which is also a first for what I've seen. And but them buying more than 25% of the common also put them in default under their credit agreement. So they did kind of need to help them out. The board hasn't fought it at all. The entire leadership there has kind of rolled over and let this happen. So very weird situation, not at all what I expected. And I'm still waiting to get some answers on what exactly went wrong in Q4 for them. The release they put out said they liquidated more inventory than they expected, but at lower margins, which essentially sounds like they were just selling things at a loss more than they needed to, which doesn't make a whole lot of sense from a strategy standpoint. Made me significantly question what they're doing over there. So no idea. Tough loss to take, but overall, thought I had a pretty good thesis and feel like I got blindsided by something that I genuinely did not see coming.
Yeah, I mean, that stuff happens, and it was weird because if you look back at Children Place, like the history of the company, it was very stable, stable cash flow generation through cycle, which was part of your thesis. It was like, look, like during the great financial crisis of 2008-2009, like they generated cash and they were a serial acquirer of shares. Like they just cannibalized their own shares. And so if you look back and like part of the process is like, okay, like let's look back at history and let's like as a base case, assume that the last 10 years will, or the next 10 years will probably look like the past 10 years to some degree. And it was hard to see kind of this mismanagement coming, but if there's anything that you took from this, because this is the other interesting part, it's like when investments go wrong, you don't want to overanalyze because there's just the randomness of life and the complexity of markets and people. But when you look back, is there anything that you take from this lesson or from this investment and say, okay, like going forward now for the next retail opportunity, like I want to focus on this, or I want to avoid this?
Sure. No, that's a great question. I'm still waiting again to get a little more detail on what exactly went wrong to clarify, what did I miss, since the company hasn't so fully disclosed what's going on in Q4. But as best I can tell, they spent close to 5 years selling the market on this transformation of moving more goods through direct to consumer, moving more product through Amazon. They've been leading a ton of categories on Amazon. It seemed like they were executing it well, and they didn't have a handle on their DC costs. They didn't have a handle on the unit economics of moving those sales out of their stores and onto the DCC platform. And that was a move that, given how much effort they had put into that, I overestimated their ability to do it and do it well. And like you said, it's been a very steady company. It seemed well run, seems consistent in their ability to generate cash. They seemed like they had been fairly forward thinking on how they'd approach this. And I gave them credit for an ability to execute that they apparently did not have. So there was some turnover in the CFO ranks there, and I think I underweighted that as a potential risk. The former CFO, who from all accounts was a very sharp individual, retired in, I believe it was 2021, and they had a short tenure of a new guy that came in and left, and the current individual seems solid, but I do question, how you could be halfway through a quarter where your costs are blowing out and not have a handle on that. It suggests that there was less controls in place than there should have been. And looking back, that was probably a sign to get out and move on. Although if you had sold the morning after that earnings report, I think you got out at pretty much the same price as if you sold after hours the night that they said they were insolvent. So wouldn't have really changed your returns a whole lot, but I think more concern after Q3 didn't come in where I expected in hindsight would have been much better. And I did reduce my position meaningfully as a result of that disappointment, but I was not out all the way.
Yeah. I mean, and they say like the best time, like if you panic, you panic first and just get out, have a clear head. And I mean, look, for every Destination XL, you might have 5 or 6 Children's Places, and the math still works. That's the best part.
Well, and I might have to write a corollary to the panic first one, which is if you're going to panic after someone buys 54% of the float.
Yeah. And just launches at 350%.
Yeah.
That's just wild, man. Yeah, that is just wild. All right, let's dive in to Gen Restaurant Group. So this is a name, just as like a backstory. So I found this from one of our collective members at MacroOps. He said, hey, look, I knew you wrote about Kura Sushi back in, what was it, like 2020, 2021. I think this is just like it, but I think it's a little bit better. And that was all I needed to kind of do the work. And I looked at the investor deck. I read the last annual report and everything like that. And I said, okay, this is exactly like Kura Sushi, but I think it's better. And started talking around different people. And then we met for lunch and I pitched you. I was like, hey, you should look at this idea that I just wrote up and bought Gen Restaurant. You're like, yeah, we own it. And I said, okay, perfect. So I'm fishing in the right spots. So again, for those that have no idea what this company is, what they do, it's a restaurant stock. So I'm sure a lot of people are a little bit like ick to it. Walk us through why this is such an interesting situation.
Sure. So this was a bit of a busted IPO. Gen came public last year, right in the wake of the kind of Kava reopening the IPO market craze. And they came out with some pretty interesting, albeit relatively small footprint. These guys are a franchisor, or not a franchisor, an operator of Korean barbecue restaurants. They have about 30 restaurants at the time they came public. So pretty small footprint. But they have a goal, I think you called out in your write-up, to grow to around 250 over time. So pretty long growth runway. Majority of the shares sit with the founders. I mean, they did a relatively small IPO of about 20% of the shares. But a large amount are still sitting with insiders, and you'll know they came out of their lockup after the IPO and nobody sold. In fact, quite a few of them opened their wallets back up and bought quite a bit of the stock here in the last couple of weeks after their latest earnings report. So ton of insider alignment here. One of the first things that got me interested here has been the unit economics on their stores. So their boxes have generally been doing around $5 million of revenue per year, which is a really good number for a concept like this. They do around 20% EBITDA margins in their location. So, in terms of profitability, you're getting around $1 million of four-wall profit that's coming out each year. And that's, with their 2 to 3 million setup costs, you're seeing cash on cash returns around 40%, couple year payback period. So just really good unit economics for these locations. So yeah, that definitely got on my radar. I like that they're cash positive. I mean, their balance sheet they're sitting on close to $40 million of cash, no debt, and they're able to self-fund their growth because they're generating cash from operations. So I really like the lack of risk here, the insider alignment, the unit economics seemed like it. After the IPO kind of ended up in the busted category, it's like, all right, this is might take a little while to get some attention again, but it seems cheap and like it's gonna work over time.
And you mentioned $5 million in revenue per store, and you said that's a good number for what they do. What are you framing that against? Like, what's your reference point? Like, why is 5 million good versus 3 or 4 million?
So with a concept like this, I mean, you're looking at, all right, this is an all you can eat concept. People are going to come in, they're going to pay the door price, and then they're going to sit there for a while and cook their own food on their table. So in their case, you want to go compare it to other relatively large box concepts. I mean, I think they're around 6,000 square feet a location. So I think one of the ones I went out and compared this to was something like a Chewy's, I think, which has closer to a 100 store footprint. Just trying to think about like, all right, four restaurants of similar size, similar kind of unit economics, are they in the same ballpark? And they compete pretty well on that front. So I like that. I also like their advantage that, compared to someone like that, they don't have chefs. They're just a cook-it-yourself, all-you-can-eat restaurant. So they have a nice labor advantage here where, they don't have to hire as much for specialty and for people that can come in and cook the food. They essentially just have to plate it from a Sysco truck that drops it off. So you have really nice advantage, too, compared to other concepts that are trying to grow and are dealing with labor pressures as they open new locations. Jen has probably the lowest bar of any restaurant operator I've come across for labor hiring.
And I don't know if you mentioned this earlier, but it's founder-led, still founder-run. I think it's a two-person founding team? I know one guy founded it. Maybe another guy came in and co-founded the company, but they started in California. And this was like an interesting wrinkle in our conversation where, like, if you're starting a business in California, like, you are busting your chops in probably the hardest place to do business in America. And so it makes it like, and I put this in my write-up, which I might release soon, but I put it in my write-up where, like, if they can generate the unit economics they did with most of their stores in California, then there's tons of upside to the unit economics as they go across the country, as they head east to Texas and you know, some parts across the Northeast.
Yeah, that's a great point. And you know, I ran across these guys as I was getting ready to go down to ICR in January and going through their stuff. And a friend of mine had flagged them as someone I should go take a look at. And I really enjoyed hearing their CEO speak there. And he talked a lot about what you're saying, that you know, they started in California. They had a footprint out there. He said, and then we opened a location in Texas. He said, I'm never opening another location in California after I experienced Texas. You wouldn't believe, because like, people pay the same amount for my food. My workers' comp costs are a tenth of what they were in California. My labor costs so much less. You know, he's like, Texas is amazing. I'm gonna open every restaurant I can in Texas. So yeah, it was an entertaining presentation. He talked a lot about what that's been like for them as they've expanded, and overall just seeing like, look, we've got, you know, we started somewhere where we have a good customer base. They do well in California, but they really like how their concept translates as they've been expanding it across the U.S. And I mean, they're already in New York City, they're in Florida, they're in Texas, they're in Arizona, they're in Nevada. They've got new locations coming in the coming year in a few other states. Like, they're so far seeing proof of concept everywhere they're going. There's quite a bit of potential for this. And it seems like overall, they've got a pretty long runway for this. They're really the only chain Korean barbecue concept that's scaled like this. I think there's one or two others that are maybe at like 5 or 7 locations. But with them being, you know, close to 40 now, they really have a scale advantage on everyone else in the space. There's no one else coming in here that's doing anything near what they're doing.
Yeah. And that's part of, it's actually something I want to discuss. But one thing I wanted to mention is the interesting environment and kind of the fun that you can have at a restaurant like this. And this is where it goes back to Jenk being a Kura Sushi 2.0. Cause I don't know if you've been into a Kura Sushi, but I went to the one in DC with the same guy that actually pitched me on Jen Restaurant, at Macrops. And it was like the coolest experience. Like, sushi just comes on a conveyor belt right to your table, and you can order like whatever sushi you want. And it's like right in front of you. You just take it off the plate. It's awesome. And Jen has that same feel where you cook over an open flame. It's super fun. It's engaging. But the flip side to that is, how much of a concept is this as like an event versus some place you go just to kind of sit down and enjoy a meal without feeling like you have to do all the work? Like, is that like a barrier to entry, you think, or is that something that's just completely like, I'm looking into it too much?
I mean, so far it seems like the traffic wise, they're doing very well. It doesn't seem like, at least up to this point, there's been any issues with, you know, traffic really falling off after like the first few months of being open. So it seems like people really enjoy this concept. You know, it's, having done some Korean barbecue myself over the years, it's a good time. It's, you know, you kind of get more interaction with people at your table as you're figuring out kind of, you know, you see how people cook their food and what, you know, what your different approaches are. And it's just more interactive experience. I pitched this to a friend of mine who used to run a fund, and I got a video back a couple of days later of, called one of his buddies and was like, hey, go check out the one that's down the road from you and like, send me a report, tell me what it was like. So I haven't been to one yet. There's nothing here in the DC area. I've been trying to get out to one. But everything I've heard has been really positive customer reception from people that have tried it out.
Yeah, I'd love to get, in a perfect world, I would get one of the co-founders on the podcast and we would do a live in-person podcast in one of their restaurants.
I'm sure they would be interested in doing something like that.
Which actually brings me to a point, another kind of bearish contention. And again, like I think this is kind of overblown slash temporary, but I think a lot of people have apprehensions on the co-founders and their ability to kind of scale this to a large corporation, like a 250 plus establishment that can interact with shareholders, that can provide whether it's guidance or expectations in a way that a seasoned kind of CEO or CFO would. What's your thoughts? I know you've met with them and you've talked with them. Like how low of a hurdle is that for them to kind of get themselves acclimated to the public markets?
Yeah, no, it takes time. And I think they're still kind of learning the ropes of being public company operators. I mean, frankly, you know, meeting with them at ICR and getting some time just one-on-one, you know, I feel like they're really good operators. And I think they may have underestimated how harsh the street would be on them for any delays in new units or any issues with margins as they're scaling and trying to how they're communicating that. So there's some growing pains there, but I got the impression both from meeting with them and just from looking at what they've done so far that they are very competent and know what they're doing in running a restaurant. And so, you know, whether or not a new restaurant opening slips into the next quarter or not bugs me a lot less than, hey, it seems like you got something that's working here. And longer term, I think you're going to build a very successful concept. You know, there's certainly some noise and some pain that comes with going public and, you know, having to scale this operation, but I think they've got the right pieces in place to keep doing it at a pretty effective level.
So how do you think about valuing something like this? I mean, this is a kind of a unit concept where you could say, okay, they've got 35, 37 stores today. I think in a few years they'll have 50 or 100. Here's how much they'll make in each store. And then you assign some sort of confidence interval to that, or is it a little bit different?
Sure. So like, if you step back and look at, you know, where it's trading today, there's about 32 million shares outstanding. If you add up the A and the B shares that insiders are still sitting on, it's good. You know, based on their guidance, they're going to generate around 20 million EBITDA midpoint this year. So just in a steady state, I mean, that's not crazily expensive for a restaurant concept with the kind of growth runway they have. When I was buying into this thing, I was doing it at close to a 10% free cash flow yield at where they, you know, just steady state what they already had open. I still think that this concept overall can stall a lot earlier than 250 units and do very well. A $330 million market cap with, you know, $30 plus million of cash on the balance sheet, self-funding growth. I mean, there's a lot worse ways to get killed in the market than get involved with something like that that has these kind of unit economics. I think maybe, you know, one key concern that I'll be watching in terms of how I'm valuing it is just understanding where they're going to scale SG&A to and what the puts and takes on that are going to be as they continue to grow. They do have to build out the nationwide infrastructure as they start scaling, and they're not just in, you know, primarily in California. I do feel really good about their Sysco contract is where they're getting their food from. And it feels like the right place for them to be. I think that previously was much more patchwork and not as efficient. So I think that, you know, getting that in place is the kind of stuff you like to see where you're like, all right, I think they have the right distribution, you know, to have a national producer like that that can distribute their food wherever they're open. It shouldn't be as many growing pains with that. I think the other thing that they're still trying to figure out too is just making sure that they have the right incentives in place for their unit operators. The key point they pointed me to on that was just looking at table turns. You know, it's an all-you-can-eat concept, so the way that you're going to maximize your dollars here and minimize your wait times is turning tables. And so figuring out a way to do that as efficiently as possible and making sure that operators that, you know, at each of their units are best incentivized to do that well, I think is going to be a key metric to watch for them, making sure that they're doing that well. Because I think the I mean, the biggest negative I've seen in looking through reviews and customer experience has been the wait times. I think that the New York location, people have said, can, you know, get 2 hour wait to get in at points. Demand is there. So now you gotta get them through the restaurant.
Yeah. And so when you go to look at, and it's kind of crazy. So when this thing sold off after earnings, traded down to, you know, below $6, at one point it was a $200 million market cap. And, you know, like you said, like $200 million market cap with net cash, depending on how you value the, you know, the leases or how you count for the leases. It's, you know, you could have penciled in that 10 to 12% cash flow yield without any other store openings, which, for a concept like this, that's self-funding growth with insiders buying back stock, it seemed pretty asymmetric. And again, just reminded me of Kura Sushi. So, but I did have a couple questions on the lease treatment and how you treat those with these specific types of companies, because when I published my write-up, I had a couple people reach out and they say, oh, well, you know, I looked on Coifin or I looked on Ticker and looks like they've got net debt. And I was like, well, that's if you count the leases as debt versus some sort of operating expense. So how do you think about that?
I think you kind of have to pick your poison there. I know this was a recent accounting change, but like if you're not going to, if you're going to count the leases as debt, then are you going to pull those out as an operating expense because you're, you know, essentially running it through your P&L every year? So, I mean, if you pull out their lease costs, then the earnings look a whole lot better. If you're going to leave, you know, if you're going to leave those in and ignore them as debt, then, you know, you're, you know, lower operating income, but you're also not going to have the same balance sheet liability. So I think you should be picking one. I understand why that's a concern for folks, but I guess looking at this concept, I mean, they're growing. As far as I can tell, they haven't really bombed the location yet. So, you know, lease liabilities come into question when you've got to potentially shut stuff down or you've got to maybe think about rationalizing your footprint. These guys are looking to grow. And I don't think there's a single lease in their portfolio that is even remotely close to saying, hey, do we need to close this restaurant? So if that were a problem, you know, then this would definitely come more into focus. But I prefer not to view leases as debt unless I'm looking at a situation where a company's going to need to try and get out of some and potentially have to pay to do that. And that's not what's happening here.
And then a couple of questions, just looking at the financials, the EBITDA margins for this business over kind of a last 12-month basis, looking back, have ranged anywhere from, you know, let's, you know, forget kind of 2020, obviously, but anywhere from 7% on the low end, which is what they just kind of put out. And then you've got 12 to 15% on the high end, which is what they did in 2021. Yep. How do you think about that margin profile over time? I know you said that there's some assumptions you have to make about SG&A that are a little bit cloudy, but how are you roughly guiding to where they'll be at a steady state?
Sure. So that's a great question. And some of that is going to be, you know, I think there's a little bit of guesswork involved here on where that's going. I mean, they had quarters in 2021 where they were putting up like 26, 27% restaurant level margins. More recently, they've pulled back closer to the 18 to 20 range. So there is a little bit of guesswork on, hey, where do these things kind of land as they expand? And, you know, you go back and look at another like hot growth concept like Shake Shack or something where it started out and, you know, AUVs are up here, margins are up here, and there's some deceleration as you start building it out and kind of diluting, you know, your best locations. So there are puts and takes there. I think, you know, this works at a 20% store level margin. It works at 18%. I think long term, you know, 10 seems to be about where they're guiding to this year at a company level. And I think that going forward, they can hold or grow that number. I don't think the SG&A growth is going to outpace that going forward. And so, you know, again, 10% margins here at a company level, that works. If we can get some growth off that number, it really works. So I feel pretty good underwriting it where it's sitting. And, you know, I think longer term, you can see, you know, somewhere in the 12 to 14% company level margin without, you know, too crazy of assumptions.
And then obviously the revenue top line growth is a function of store openings plus, you know, kind of same restaurant sales growth. And, you know, from, again, kind of get rid of 2021 because that's comping off 2020, but if you look, 2022 was, call it 16.5, 23 was 10.5. And, you know, I think part of that kind of busted IPO was you've got this concept that's showing year over year declining growth. I mean, still growth, still double digits. And again, like you could buy, like you could have bought this business for less than, I think, 0.8 times EV to sales. So like you're not paying for this monstrous growth at all. But if I'm trying to determine why people would sell a stock like this, that top line deceleration is one reason. And so how do you see that changing over time or evolving?
Look, I mean, one of the issues you have with smaller footprint concepts like this is that specific issues can cause outside impacts. And so in Jen's case, like Q4 this past year, they have a concentration of restaurants in Southern California that dealt with some pretty significant adverse weather. And so there were locations that weren't generating earnings, and that, you know, in aggregate, their portfolio, you know, deceleration looks worse with a relatively benign event that doesn't impact a whole lot of publicly traded restaurant companies the same way it impacts someone with such a small footprint. So I do think there's some one-off issues here, and I always like getting involved in situations where I feel like the impacts aren't fully understood by the market. You know, part of that can be on management to communicate it clearly and set expectations that they can clear. But I also think here that that's something that maybe people don't fully understand. Like, hey, you know, they have a pretty decent, they got 15 locations in Southern California. That's almost half their footprint that was operating in the fall. You know, hey, adverse weather there is going to impact their same store sales more than people expect. So yeah, there's deceleration, but I think that there's, you know, a bigger picture there that some people might be missing, and it's going to be on them to then, you know, start proving that out this year by hitting and exceeding the guidance that they're putting out and showing that, you know, there were some one-off issues that they're able to lap and improve on.
Yeah. And I think Jen is a great example of when investing, you don't want to simplify to the point where you're missing key details, but you also don't want to get too far in the weeds when an idea doesn't require it. And I know that kind of sounds counterintuitive, but with Jen, it's, to me, it's very simple. It's, are they opening more stores at paces that they say they are or exceeding, and are customers coming and enjoying the experience? And that, like, to me, that's it. Like, that's all you need to follow to understand this story. And obviously, like, pay attention to margins, pay attention to costs. If things blow out, like, obviously take heed of that. But at the end of the day, if they're opening stores across the country, they're growing, the demand is there, customers are loving it, you don't really need to focus too much on all that minutia.
Look, I mean, I agree. I think, again, by and large, they have not crashed and burned in any location yet where they open a place and like, look, this just isn't working. They disclosed that so far that the new concepts that opened most recently, they're all hitting their 5 million annual unit volume target. So, you know, they seem to be getting the numbers they want in the markets they want. And it, as like you said, as long as that continues, you know, it's really hard to see how you lose here.
Yeah. I mean, and they like this, that, you know, they had, call it 21 million in debt in 2020, and they paid all that off. It's a clean balance sheet. They did 22 million in cash from operations this past year. And now they've got 17 million in CapEx, but that's because they're building new stores. And it's just an exciting concept. I mean, do you think they'll get a restaurant in Virginia so you and I can visit at some point in the next 12 months?
Hopefully. I know I brought up opening one in Northern Virginia and made a comment about the number of ones we already have here. And they're like, oh, rent in Northern Virginia is pretty expensive. We'll have to see. So, you know, I don't know how soon we may end up with one, but I don't know, maybe we'll have to go down to Texas or something for a site on-site visit.
So last time I had you on the podcast, it was 2023, I believe. Mm-hmm. And you know, you've had another year under your belt. You guys are doing well. Is there anything that you've added to your process or eliminated to your process that you think has made you a better investor this year, or things that you want to do to make you a better investor by the end of the year?
Ooh, good question. I think every time I talk to somebody about this, I just point out that the level to which management and alignment and competency matters when you're investing in small caps, you can't overcome really bad and or incompetent management. So, you know, looking at an idea like this where you have so much insider ownership and a lot of insider buying, this just draws me in way more than maybe a similar restaurant concept or a similar valuation might. So I think, and then broadly speaking, that just across our portfolio, starting to realize that owning something where I'm really just praying for somebody to execute that doesn't have a consistent history of executing is a consistently frustrating experience. So I am writing stuff off much quicker now than I would have years ago, just based on the quality of execution and the quality of the team that's in place.
And I know that you invest in coal, which is very close to other mining companies like copper, gold, and silver, which I've been bugging you about. Have you dipped your toes in any of these spaces? Have you started to try to familiarize yourself with that? And if so, what does that look like?
Oh, I've got one junior miner in the portfolio. I feel like it's too small to even mention on here. But I have there's some interesting stuff out there that I do enjoy, but it's also a space that I, you know, don't feel like I can get the best informational advantage in. So I think people will do well to listen to people that know more than me talk about mining companies for the most part. I like my coal. That's kind of where I found my niche up to this point.
And I mean, super, super topical, but the Key Bridge in Baltimore collapsed this morning / overnight, which is like 30 minutes from my house. So it was pretty wild. I had a cousin that was in the Coast Guard that's about to be stationed in Baltimore. And so he had a couple buddies send some pictures of what it looked like. And how big of a deal is that for the coal market? I mean, it's going to take a while for that to clean up and for them to kind of get everything ready again. Is that disruptive? Is that not a huge deal? What's your initial take there?
Yeah, so obviously very thankful that happened at 2 a.m. and not during rush hour, given it, you know, it seems like that will be much more minimal casualties than maybe could have been for such a total bridge collapse. In terms of the impact on the coal market, I think the primary victims of trading so far today were Consol and Arch, which put a lot of coal through the Baltimore port. I think Consol was down 6 or 7%. Arch was down like 3 or so last I looked. B. Riley put out a note on them already today that suggested that the sell-off was probably overdone. But generally speaking, in the resource space, if something bad happens, people sell first and ask questions later. So I could see there being some continued weakness there until there's actual, you know, visibility onto what the reopening timeline looks like there. You know, if it's a month or so, then, you know, the impact should be relatively minimal. I imagine that there will be pretty concerted effort to get traffic going back through the port as fast as possible, just given the volume of shipping that happens there. But overall, for the coal names, I don't think this is going to have much of a long-term impact. And, you know, even if there is ongoing disruptions as they try to get the bridge rebuilt, I think that will be relatively limited in how it impacts the coal equities.
Gotcha. Well, look, I appreciate you coming on and deep diving into Gen Restaurant. I'm trying to get these podcasts out before my wife has her baby, because I feel like I won't be able to just sling a podcast real quick. Are there any other spots of the market, any other corners that you're exploring that have you excited? You don't have to name names if stuff is small, but just ideas and things like that.
One theme that I would say I'm still doing some work on and I think would be interesting for a lot of value folks like myself would be media stocks that are exposed to political spending in 2024. I think there's some of these stocks that are trading at lows. They're going to do a lot of cash flow this year and maybe trading at prices that don't make a whole lot of sense given how this year is shaping up on a political spending front. So I would say that's one interesting area to be turning over rocks right now. Like I said earlier, obviously, we've definitely talked about coal. And I think there continue to be some interesting opportunities there. I think, there's still some interesting trades in offshore as well. I've gotten involved via Tidewater. That's one that I think the thesis is pretty well known. But it's just been a fun stock to own. I think I often try to buy things that are more difficult. And man, Tidewater is just slowly executing and doing exactly what they said they were going to do and buying back stock and just dominating the OSV space. I know there's some people that got burned in this thing pre-COVID and are hesitant to get back in. But I think the team they've got in there right now is doing a really good job and has been one of the easiest stocks to own that I've been involved in for a while. So I think that space continues to be interesting. And for people like me that have a hard time buying charts that have already gone up, man, it can be fun. So
imagine that, buying something that's working.
Yeah, I definitely am enjoying that more than I thought I would. Held my nose and bought a chart that was up and not looking back.
It's funny, man. I'm doing the exact opposite this year. I'm trying to buy pullbacks and I'm trying to buy lows, because buying breakouts and buying stuff that's working intuitively makes more sense to me. Even holding kind of this value investing philosophy. But you mentioned that you tend to get attracted to things that are more complex, maybe not for the sake of actual risk-adjusted returns, but for the sake of them being complex. And why do you think that is? And why do you think that, because I know that not only you struggle with that, but a lot of people I know and a lot of smarter people have that same sort of struggle. So why do you think that is?
Well, I would put an important footnote on there, which is I think I like buying things that are complex that I think are going to simplify. And that is where a lot of the trade can really work, is when something maybe wasn't as straightforward and becomes that way. I really like, if I feel like I'm close to something that's finally getting things to go right, that's your opportunity. I think, the market doesn't pay you to own complex stories and doesn't pay you to figure them out. And generally, if something is complex and misunderstood, you've got to have a reason for why you think that's going to change, because you're just going to buy something that is still complex and misunderstood. And you owning it doesn't fix that. So I don't really want to own something that's complex unless I think that the situation is getting better in terms of being understood by the market.
And that's how I view mining stocks and like these small to mid-tier junior producers. Like, it doesn't have to be complex. I just want to find stuff where management's buying back stock and they're paying dividends and they've got a ton of cash, little to no debt, and that's it. Like, and then I kind of been noodling with this idea that every company is a mining stock, and maybe it's for like a larger write-up, but like, the more I dive into the space and like look at these producers that are cash flowing with low ASICs, it's like there's really not much difference between your run-of-the-mill mining company that is a cash flow producer than any other business out there. At least that's kind of the hill that I'm standing on. I don't know if you agree or not.
I will look forward to reading your more in-depth pitch on that.
That's a kind way of saying that you think I'm totally full of it. Very wrong.
Every stock is a junior miner is quite the claim.
I didn't say junior miner. I said every stock is a mining stock. Huge difference.
I added the word junior. I shouldn't have done that.
There you go. Adding complexity again. David, this was awesome, man. I appreciate you hopping on short notice to discuss a really interesting idea that, again, like, we both own. So do your own work. This is not advice. I think this is compelling, but find out if it's compelling on your own. And if people want to go and learn more about you and what you do at Kingdom, where can they go to find you?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter a good bit at Kingdom Cap ADV, KingdomCapitalAdvisors.com. I've got my letters out there, talk about some of the stuff we own, our process. You can definitely get a hold of me either of those spots, and always down to talk about ideas, and I'll try to get back to you as soon as I can.
Awesome. And I know I asked you this last year, don't know if it's changed, but if you could have dinner with anyone from the past, present, or future, who would it be?
Oh man. So yeah, last year I told you Roberto Clemente, the former Pirates baseball player.
Yep.
Which you were at least happy wasn't Warren Buffett.
Yeah, so, always.
He's definitely still on the list. I think he'd be the guy. What second guy? I wasn't expecting to get hit with this another time. Yeah, I mean, right now I kind of want to get in the room with whoever actually understands what happened at Children's Place over the last 3 months. just for curiosity's sake, I would whoever knows everything right now, I would love to grab a beer with you and pick your brain because, yeah, one of the most unique outcomes I've seen in public markets in a while. So I would love to know the sequence of events there, and I don't know that I ever will. So there's another weird one for you.
I love it, man. Awesome. Thanks so much. Best of luck the rest of the year, and can't wait for the next idea that you've got, no matter how weird or complex. I appreciate you.
Thanks, Brandon.
Today's episode is also brought to you by Marhelm Data. Marhelm is an information service for investors to find real value in an overvalued market. With a focus on shipping and commodities, Marhelm helps you stay on the pulse of global trade, track global sentiment, and identify compelling global investment opportunities. ValueHive listeners can get 20% off a Marhelm data subscription by using the code VALUE at checkout. That's VALUE at checkout. Head on over to marhelm.com, marhelm.com to get your discount today. This episode is brought to you by Ticker. Ticker.com is focused on bringing institutional-level investment research to you, the individual investor. Ticker.com is powered by S&P Global Capital IQ and has coverage of over 50,000 stocks globally with financial data, estimates, valuation metrics, ownership percentages, transcript filings, news, and more. ValueHive listeners can join Ticker's free beta trial today at ticker.com/hive. That's TIKR.com/hive.